are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Bristling with suspense, action, and authenticity, Brigadier General A.J. Tata's new thriller, 3 Minutes to Midnight, delivers a terrifyingly plausible scenario ripped from the headlines. When a nuclear plant is attacked and then another, Delta Force veteran Jake Magan knows it's a ruthlessly orchestrated assault on our homeland that even the best intelligence agencies could ever foresee or stop. Now a third nuclear plant is targeted. Magan has no choice but to try and stop it. If he fails, our nation falls. The countdown is launched. The clock is ticking. Armageddon begins. 3 Minutes to Midnight. 3 Minutes to Midnight is the new thriller by A.J. Tata. It's now available everywhere books are sold and at KensingtonBooks.com.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 3rd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Malcolm Nance, former Arabic-speaking naval intelligence counterterrorism and intelligence officer specializing in the Middle East, on defeating ISIS, who they are, how they fight, what they believe. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we're getting super aggressive with a 35-year field and combat intelligence vet.
Yeah, but does he do thought experiments? Yeah.
We'll see. Also on the program today, another Johnson & Johnson baby powder verdict. Millions of dollars. Ted Cruz, not a killer, says his wife. Maybe gives a non-denial denial. How big of a drag will Donald Trump be on Republican hopes to maintain the Senate? And meanwhile, Trump says, while Ted Cruz may not be the serial killer, what was his dad doing when it came to JFK?
We were both serial killers. Dad, you must kill them.
Also, Hillary Clinton's down-ticket fundraising, a bit more up-ticket than first reported. Detroit teachers, is it day two of a strike or day two of a lockout? And Glenn Beck's Blaze is a blaze, ladies and gentlemen, and not in a good way. Oh, boy. And also, on a happy note, it is May, and at this point in the year, the United States toddlers have shot 23 people. Only 23 people at this point, toddlers. So, that's not to say how many toddlers have been shot, inadvertently, of course. I mean, because, you know, people aren't going to shoot toddlers on purpose. But, you know, that's just something to think about. let me just talk. I guess we should do this Detroit public schools things first. I was going to talk about the Blaze thing. Longtime listeners know, and I believe I said this in the public show, not just the fun half, but about a year ago, I think I started telling people to pay attention to what's going on with Glenn Beck's empire, that it was crumbling and nobody was reporting on it. I had talked to a couple of inside sources who were telling me, it's a disaster. And, you know, you could see it if you ever took the time to go look at their website and see what shows. I knew what shows they were offering at one point, and then you go and visit and you realize, like, wait a second, all those shows seem to be gone. But we will get to that later in the program. It's just another example, folks, how if you want the news from tomorrow or 6 months from now, you listen to this program today. Meanwhile, it is day two of a... It's really, I don't know, it's a question. Is it a strike? Is it a lockout? 94 out of 97 public schools are closed yesterday. Those schools, for the most part, are closed today. Detroit teachers have not shown up. They're taking sick days. But it's also one of those things where, hey, if you stop paying us, why would we continue to work? In other words, the Detroit public school system has stopped issuing checks for 2/3 of Detroit teachers as of Friday. They're just simply not going to receive all their checks. Teachers can choose to receive 22 paychecks or 26 paychecks in terms of how they prefer to get paid. But apparently, some people like to receive checks throughout the year, so they get smaller ones because they don't know, because they're over the summer. So they want to parse it out. Nevertheless, the school basically has... the school system has basically stopped paying about 2/3 of the teachers. So for teachers who receive 26 checks, they're going to miss 5 paychecks for work performed during the school year, which is almost 20% of their annual pay. Could you tomorrow accept an immediate and unplanned 20% cut in pay? It's unbelievable what's going on in Michigan. The state is a disaster. If they're not poisoning their own citizens, they're then refusing to pay their teachers. I wonder if in the state house, any of those lawmakers are taking a 20% pay cut. And you can be absolutely sure that if these teachers were a majority white, that they'd be getting their paychecks. Unbelievable. Unbelievable what's going on in that state. It's disgusting. Really disgusting. I got a little feedback yesterday for those who listened to the free show. We had a couple of ads, not the least of which was one from libertarianism.org, which is a Cato Institute-sponsored organization that ostensibly teaches you about the freedom-loving ideology of libertarianism.
Hey, man, if the Chevy is not safe in Guatemala, I go to my sweatshop job and I get a Volvo.
Someone A longtime listener on Twitter said, you didn't mention anything about the increased cost that would be involved in equipping these cars with some form of safety measures that would raise it presumably from a zero-star rating to like a one-star or a two-star or a four-star or five-star. And it is true. In the manufacturing of these vehicles, I imagine there would be, I don't know how significant of a cost, but certainly a cost, right? I mean, just an airbag alone costs an extra couple hundred dollars probably. I don't know if it costs that way if you buy them in bulk like a GM does, but let's presume that between the airbags and installing of the seatbelts, there's a couple hundred dollars more of cost. That doesn't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily mean that that cost is passed on to a consumer. It's possible, but not necessarily. We don't know what the, I don't know what the elasticity of the price points are for cars in Latin America. I don't know if that would change the insurance rates for consumers in Latin America. I don't know about car insurance down there. I don't know that it would save these countries a significant amount in healthcare because they're not having as bad of accidents. Injuries are not as large because of things like airbags or seatbelts. I don't know that GM wouldn't just eat some of the profits. I don't know that the state, if they found that it was making cars outside of too expensive, couldn't simply put price controls on it. I mean, we had price controls. Remember that in this country on all sorts of things. You remember the conversation we had with Meg Jacobs from Friday of last week. We had price controls in this country. So there are many different ways in which it's possible that those costs wouldn't go up. So I didn't raise it. It's also conceivable that the cars could cost slightly more. I mean, we went through this with the Pinto, didn't we? When we had a libertarian call us and say, hey, man, I'm not sure that I wouldn't just... Pinto. As long as you tell us that it's going to blow up when it gets hit from behind, I might buy it.
No, that was the question. They were like, well, wait a second. Did the seller say that upon impact, this thing will incinerate you?
So anyways, in addition to the feedback we've gotten, some people were like, yeah, take the Cato Institute's money. Some people say, don't. It's wrong. You're going to be sending impressionable people to their site. Well, listen, first of all, if you go to the site after you listen to the show and you find stuff there that you think makes sense to you, call back in onto this program. In fact, I encourage you, go there. Tell them the Majority Report sent you. So they keep funding this show. It's the first time we've had any ideological backing of this show. Now I know what it feels like to be one of these right-wingers who get on the right-wing dole. It's sweet. But I also got an email from somebody who said, hey, man, if you're going to take libertarianism.org ads, would you take an ad from me at a discounted rate? And he told me what the cause was. And I said, not only will I take it from you at a discounted rate, we're doing a program here. where libertarianism.org is subsidizing your program. So everybody's getting in on this whole right-wing dole. The Texas Debate Collective was created in 2009 to allow low-income students to access the highest levels of competitive high school debate. TDC provides high-quality debate education to students from low-income schools and communities each summer through its annual summer debate camp. Camp is mostly subsidized by students from rich and middle-income communities who pay full price, allowing poorer students to attend for free. Right now, TDC needs your donations after the dorm they contracted with decided to double their prices for room and board. Donations to cover this price hike can be made at tdc2016.causevox.com. We'll put that link up on majority.fm. If you'd like to donate year-round to support students from some of Texas' poorest school districts, go to texasdebatecollective.org/donate. Any help is appreciated. Any donation to TDC will support building the critical thinking skills of those that desperately need it, people who attend public schools in Texas. And hopefully one of these students who we help will go out and debate some libertarian someday and make sure that their policies don't gut our country. And when they do, ladies and gentlemen, if they are a guy or if they're a lady who also likes to shave, I hope they'll use their Harry's.com razor. Stop compromising on your shave and get started with Harry's. For far too long, you, and I'm talking to you, have either paid too much for a comfortable shave or you've settled for a low price but low quality razor. Harry's offers you something you've never had before, a great shave at a fair price. Harry's makes its own quality razors. Cut out the middleman, ship them directly to you for half the price of the leading brand. Good shave, good price. Super simple. Get both of them with Harry's. You know how much I enjoy shaving now relative to how much I enjoyed shaving before. I shaved yesterday because I thought I might be doing Hayes. Hayes wanted me to do tonight at midnight, but I can't do it because I got to wake up tomorrow morning with 6 a.m. with Saul. But if I was, I would be clean shaven today, and I would have done it with Harry's.
I mean, look, you enjoy shaving so much with Harry's. It's disgusting.
It's disgusting.
It's true.
Harry's starter is just $15. That includes a razor, 3 blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming gel. Me, I think you know I like the foaming gel because I'm now using my little feather brush that my dad made me buy 30 years ago. I'm growing older, ladies and gentlemen. As an added bonus, you get $5 off your first purchase with my code MajorityReport. That's right. After you use my code, you get an entire month's worth of shaving for $10. The starter set is a great option for new customers and a great deal. For $15, you get the razor handle moisturizing shave cream with 3 of Harry's 5-blade German engineered razors. And again, you get $5 off your first purchase with promo code MajorityReport. Go to harrys.com right now. Look for the Truman Set. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com. Enter code MajorityReport at checkout. You get $5 off and you support the show. Stop compromising. Give Harry's a try. All right, we're going to take a quick break. I recorded this interview with Malcolm Nance last week, and it is a long one. So we'll be back in 60 minutes. Enjoy. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Malcolm Nance. He is the executive director of the counter-ideology think tank, the Terror Asymmetrics Project on Strategy, Tactics, and Radical Ideologies. He is a career counter-terrorism analyst and author of Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, and What They Believe. Malcolm, welcome to the program.
Great. Glad to be here.
So, all right, let's start with, I think to a certain extent, folks have a decent idea of their origins. But before we get to the origins, give us your assessment of how would you characterize ISIS?
Let me put it in a simple way. If Al-Qaeda, which everyone uses as the benchmark, was a deeply trained, very well-groomed organization that you had to have deep ties to get into, they would go and check your background, and they would train you as a professional terrorist. These were men who were usually much older, men who were in their 30s, sometimes 40s. They were deeply religious, extremely orthodox, and truly understood their environment, truly understood the ideology that they were coming into. And they were professional terrorists, on par with a military operation. So if Al-Qaeda were real professionals, ISIS is the equivalent of a flash mob that's been called together by a text message. So they're much younger, much faster, but they were led. They are led by, a former Iraqi fighters who grew up in the Al-Qaeda in Iraq organization. And then when they elicited their call for everyone to come to the caliphate, they got much younger people, much less knowledgeable about Islam. A lot of them had a very deep criminal background, were dispossessed within their own countries, and those guys joined ISIS in order to do one of two things, or two things, to gain the earthly power that they could get just by joining the organization, coming in and taking and pillaging, which was a specialty of theirs, and being part of this expeditionary warfare unit. Or they would come and they believed that they were carrying out this new ideology, which was going to bring about the end of times, according to, their variation of Islam. So two entirely different types of organizations with two entirely different types of effects.
But the leadership, it sounds to me like the leadership is similarly oriented. It's just that the bench is a little bit less or significantly less experienced.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the equivalent of, playing in the NBA finals with a high school team that's led by, Shaquille O'Neal and a whole bunch of the older original gangsters, as we like to call them.
Interesting.
But all of them, both groups, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, both espouse the exact same ideology, which was the variation of Islam that Osama bin Laden came up with, where he believed that they had to expunge the entire Islamic world of all the traditions of tolerance, respect, and go back to a form of Islam that didn't exist. Actually, it didn't even exist at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, when Muhammad was carrying out his little battles for survival along the Hijaz, the western Saudi Arabia coast. These guys believe that that's where Islam should be brought back to. It should be brought back to ultra, ultra orthodoxy, and parts that they don't like should be expunged, and anyone that gets in their way who's Muslim should be eliminated. And that is why I refer to them as a cult, because cults like this have existed in Islam before. And the first cult, a group called the Khawarij, were the first cult to operate like this. And the Prophet Muhammad himself even warned people about the groups like this.
So when they say they want to bring Islam back to its pure form, they're not talking about a real time, are they? I mean, is that what I'm hearing you say? They're talking about an imaginary time that existed.
Sure, and that's what's funny about it, is that they interpret the Quran through practically one phrase, which is the phrase about being only worthy to sit next to God by, fighting jihad and dying in jihad. And then they just eliminate everything else in the Quran other than religious controls, personal and political controls on people. And they believe that they have to fight and live in accordance with the people who were the immediate friends of the Prophet Muhammad. They call them the companions of the Prophet. And that is called that. There's actually a body of worship in Islam amongst the Saudis called Salafism, which is the Salaf is to live your life like the companions of the Prophet Muhammad. There's no equivalent in Christianity. Very few people want to live their lives like the 12 apostles, right?
Right.
But they mean it literally, to live their lives in accordance to what they've written, what they've said, what the Prophet had to say about them, how they dress, how they eat, how they treat people in the 7th century. And so these guys actually are living a 7th century life and imposing that 7th century template over a 21st century world using modern weapons.
And I know you also talk about the that within Islam there are five pillars, and they've actually added a couple. Explain that to us.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because the first time anyone's ever heard of the phrase seven pillars of, you know, of seven pillars of anything was T.E. Lawrence when he wrote his book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Well, Islam has five pillars in which, or obligations that every Muslim is required to do or strive to do. The first is prayer, right? Pray five times a day. The second is to fast during the holy month of Ramadan, where you fast during the daytime and then sun goes down and then you stuff yourself full of food from, you know, from dusk until dawn. And then you fast again for the remainder of that day. The third is charity, you know, zakat, to give charity, not only in your regular life, but especially during the holy month of Ramadan. And the more charity you give throughout your life, the better it is. Fourth, you have the obligation of going on Hajj, going on pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in your life during the Hajj period, you know, which is a 1 month period that generally follows Ramadan and toward, you know, in fall. Okay, and let me see, it's a little hard to keep track of these things.
Prayer, and fast, charity, and pilgrimage.
The final one is shahada, right? The witnessing, where you must say, there is no God but God, and the Prophet Muhammad is his messenger. And that's La ilaha illallah, or Muhammadu Rasulallah, right? Every Muslim, once they witness that, then, of course, that validates their belief in Islam. ISIS and Al-Qaeda believe that some obligations were left out, and they make them mandatory for anyone who's an adherent in their organization. As a matter of fact, one of their theologians, a guy by the name of Faraj, an Egyptian, wrote a book called Jihad, The Absent Obligation. And they believe that holy war is an obligation of every Muslim. Now, in the Quran, that doesn't exist. There is an obligation of jihad if a legal body calls a jihad, if it is religiously sanctioned, if it is defensive in nature, if all diplomacy has failed, and if it is done only in cases of very short duration war. These guys don't believe that. They believe that jihad is a day-to-day event that every Muslim must take part in, and their jihad is an obligation to every Muslim. And the seventh, of course, for them is martyrdom, shaheed. You must die in this jihad. You have to try to die, you know, because to die and striving to die is the holiest way of worship to God. And so, you know, it's funny because when I was over in the Middle East, I lived there for 7 years. I just came back. You know, when I talk to my Muslim friends and they sit down and I explain this to them, they go, no, 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 that's not Islam. And I go, absolutely correct. So what is it? And it turns out that there were other cults in Islam, like the Mahdiist of Sudan in the 19th century. They changed the Shahada, right, to the witnessing, to, you know, to include the name of the guy who made that sect. They also got rid of Hajj and declared that jihad was the holy war. The Muslim world quickly stamps out cults like this. And ISIS and Al-Qaeda now are just the newest one and the most virulent.
And do you think that ultimately, I mean, is this I would imagine to a certain extent, I mean, we can see similar parallels. And tell me if I'm wrong in terms of these type of cults within other major religions. And I mean, what has been the process in the past that cults like this have been stamped out by Islam? And then I want to go get more specific with ISIS.
Sure.
But I'm just curious,
sure,
because, you know, you've been out of the country for a little bit. I don't know if you've been seeing what's going on. Even on the nominal left in this country, it has become very fashionable to claim that there is something fundamentally problematic about Islam that is fundamentally different and fundamentally locked into this notion of jihad and is fundamentally at odds with coexistence with the West.
No. Yeah, that's ridiculous. And now I'm going to put on my U.S. intelligence officer's hat, right? I've only been working in this field for 35 years, and I've only specialized in the Middle East, South Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, I speak Arabic. I live with these guys. I only work with indigenous forces, okay? Which means I only live with them. I, you know, go to mosque. I eat, play with their kids, and shoot the rifle at their wedding. So let me speak from the perspective of someone who's had to immerse myself in this. You know, I don't like to say Lawrence-like, but yes, I've worn the dish dasha, and people think that I'm a local. The problem is not Islam. This, for all of its faults, Islam has been a progressive religion that has changed slowly over time. But Islam gave us art, technology, science, music, poetry, many of the things which revolutionized the Renaissance in the West. All of these things, ISIS and Al Qaeda seek to expunge. As a matter of fact, I write in the book how they believe all music except for one mark, called one type, called nasheeds, which are religious chants, should be eliminated. So it would be the equivalent of the West wanting to eliminate all music except Gregorian chants, right?
Hmm.
So Islam itself is the target of this group. There's 1.6 billion people they have to change or force to change or eliminate before they can move forward with their war to have a clash of civilizations with the West. For all of its faults, you know, most things that people see in Islam, like, you know, the wearing of hijab by women and, you know, in the niqab by women, their treatment of women, other things, their, you know, avarice, things that you see that are stereotypical, most of these things are culture. They are not religion. They preceded Islam. And every tribal group, if you actually take a look around throughout the world, lived like that. Christianity itself used head coverings and body coverings for women. As a matter of fact, if you want to see where Catholic nuns got their garb from, go to Karbala in Iraq. It's, you know, the habit is almost identical. So how did Islam get rid of these things? How did Islam root out groups that were deviant, as the Saudis like to call it? The first group, the Khawarij, there were nine men. They were eliminated down to nine men in the first Islamic civil war, the first Islamic fitna. But they still managed to kill the third caliph of Islam, Ali, and split Islam. Nine men split Islam into Sunnah and Shia by assassinating the caliph. They were wiped out, actually, by the next cult that came up, a group called the Karamata. The Karamata were, you know, an armed Shia tribe that was preparing itself for the end of times, for the return of the Mahdi, their savior. And this group believed that Hajj pilgrimages were idolatry, were polytheism. So they went to Mecca and destroyed the city of Mecca, razed it to the ground, destroyed the Kaaba, killed everyone who was worshiping there, and stole the meteorite that was inside the black box at the Kaaba. They were wiped out later by a later Islamic dynasty, but it took 27 years to hunt them down and wipe them out. The third group, the Mahdiists of Sudan, were wiped out by the Ottoman Empire with the British assistance. As a matter of fact, Winston Churchill took part in the battle at Omdurman against the Mahdiists of Sudan. And then, you know, they were just, you know, erased from the sands of time. And the final group before Al-Qaeda and ISIS were the Utabists. This was a group that seized the Grand Mosque in Mecca in 1979. The Saudis went into the Grand Mosque in a pitched multi-week battle and finally had to root them out with nerve gas. I mean, sarin gas dropped from French helicopters. You know, these clashes with these groups always end in violence. And it's going to be the Muslim world that's going to have to eliminate them by first calling them to return to Islam. And then if they don't, Islam itself will have to rule according to Islamic law against them.
What is the I mean, I guess this is, you know, a broader question about cults on some level, but what is it about these, is it a function of Islam? Is it a function of the contexts in which these groups exist? I mean, why do we see a succession of these cults that are, it seems to me, you know, particularly violent?
Well, you know, I can argue that in the Islamic perspective. There have only been these four, you know, now five cults over 1,440 years. Christianity itself, I mean, we have cults in the West and in the Christian world on a day-to-day basis, you know, but the super ultra-violent ones, we've had far more in the West from the Japanese Om Shinrikyo, which was a bizarre blend of Christianity, Buddhism, and this Soko Asahara's personal beliefs, and then the People's Temple in Guyana, where they all drank Kool-Aid and killed themselves, to right to the Branch Davidians and some of these anti-government groups. You know, but I personally think, why does an individual do this? The evidence for the modern wave of young men that have suddenly found Islam again, who were from disparate European and other Muslim world communities, were mainly that they have a personal defect within the society that they live in. So like the young men from Molenbeek in Brussels, most of them were petty criminals, couldn't get jobs, you know, lived within this, you know, very loose belief system of what they thought, you know, their Islam was, but didn't want to be like their parents and wanted to do something which would enrich and empower them. And they were seduced by the preachings of these, you know, cultist imams who say, you can come and act as the hand of God now and effect the end of times and be the highest, most honorable person within the Muslim world if you believe what we believe. And there were these guys were going over literally not understanding anything about Islam. People make this joke that, you know, two of the guys had that, you know, Islam for Dummies with them. Well, it's not a joke. These guys pick up, you know, trade words and behaviors and actions sort of like the way some of these people who, you know, young African-Americans pick up hip-hop terms. And even though they may not know them, you know, they say them. These guys pick that up, but they have a world that they could go to and literally become the special forces the next day and have rape, kill, pillage according to what they say are the highest form of Islamic law, even though we know it's not. And they become gods on earth.
And so, all right. So give us a sense of what just a sort of a broad overview of ISIS over, I guess, now the past 3 or 4 years in terms of if you could, a timeline measuring sort of their, I guess, their major highs and their lows, because it seems to me that they're off peak now. But I say that obviously as someone who's just, you know, reading from a fairly small amount of news, that in fact the tactics that they're taking now are an indication of weakness rather than strength. But give me your assessment and give us a sort of a historical timeline as to where we are now.
Sure. Well, you know, let's all go back to, you know, I call ISIS the fifth generation of Al-Qaeda, you know, Al-Qaeda 5.0. The first generation being the group that formed the organization in 1988, the second generation being the terror professionals who all came in the early 1990s when they were in Sudan and then moved to Afghanistan. Third generation were the guys who formed all the plots that led up to 9/11 and 9/11. You know, like the Khalid Sheikh Mohammeds, all of those guys, the fourth generation were Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In 2003, when we invaded Iraq, we essentially created the Petri dish that every Muslim radical in the world could come to and fight us. But one of the components that most people don't understand is not only were we fighting these foreign fighters of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI, as we call it, under the murderous beheading Abu Musab Zarqawi, right? Their videos, their beheadings were just as bad as ISIS's. But there was a completely different component. There were also the 30 to 80,000 former regime loyalists of Saddam Hussein that were fighting in the largest insurgent group in Iraq called the Jaish al-Mujahideen. And for the most part, every attack that occurred between 2008 and 2011 in Iraq, which was being carried out, you know, 90% of the time by these former regime loyalist Baathists, the U.S. media called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. You know, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was a very small organization that was almost exclusively a suicide bomber command. And the regular day-to-day killing was taking place by Baathists.
Let me just stop you there so that we get a sense of, when you say, you know, first, second, third, fourth generations, how many people are you talking about, you know, in those? When you say, you know, I mean, we know that when the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, disbanded Saddam Hussein's army. We had a lot of disaffected Baathists who basically, they lost their income, in addition to obviously losing a significant amount of power in that country. So that's the 20 to 50,000 that you're speaking of. But how many are in these various incarnations of Al-Qaeda or whatever we want to call them? How many of them are there at these different stages?
Yeah, that's a good question. They're very small. You know, 1988, when they formed in Peshawar, Pakistan, it was the few remaining Afghan Arabs, the Arabs who fought the Russians in you know, under Saudi control during the Russian-Afghan war. And you're talking maybe 1,000 men. But most of those people went home. So it came down to less than 200 is how Al-Qaeda started. Same thing when they went over to Sudan, less than a couple of hundred. When they reformed in Afghanistan, it grew to over 1,000. That's Generation 3. And Generation 3 was the group that was supposed to go back to their countries as professional saboteurs, provocateurs, and, you know, and religious theists and destabilize their nations, which is where we got Al-Qaeda, the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Shabaab, the origins of Boko Haram in Nigeria, you know, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic Maghreb. But it was supposed to be a slow burn over a century. That's what bin Laden wanted. So less than 1,000 people by the time 9/11 came into power, you know, came into play. So once 9/11 attack occurred and they showed that they had the ability to project global power and global terrorism, then they grew into the thousands. But when we invaded Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq had zero manpower in it the day of the invasion. By the time it left in 2011, it had reached peak power of up to 15,000 combatants just in Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Then next to them was fighting, you know, 30 to 80,000 former regime loyalists who were acting as terrorists on a full-time, that's about 30,000 guys, to 80,000 on a part-time basis. So now you've got 100,000.
Were they part of, was that 30 to 50, those disaffected Baathists who are in the, I guess the Anbar province would be my guess, right? More or less?
Yeah, the Sunnah Triangle, what we call the Sunnah Triangle, Anbar province, Salah ad-Din, Nineveh province. So the same territory ISIS occupies right now in Western Iraq were the groups that were all the former regime loyalists. Who were fighting the United States.
Were they in the same command structure as the AQI? In other words, were they taking orders from and following strategies and practicing tactics that were, I mean, I imagine the tactics were like, you know, sort of like there was, it was generated as they were, you know, from their Baathist days. But the were they following, were they in the command structure of AQI at that time?
Well, it was the other way around. AQI was under their command structure. There were three wings of the insurgency, the Baathist, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and all these tiny little disparate, what we call IREs, Iraqi religious extremists, who would later fall under Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So they were three parallel sets of wars going on, not to mention the Shia who attacked us in the south. So let's separate them out of this entire discussion. The Baathists fought us. They're the guys who killed the bulk of the 4,491 soldiers who were killed in Iraq. They were the day-to-day guys coming out with the rifles and ambushing us. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was almost exclusively a suicide bomb command. They would actually cooperate together. The Baathists formed weapon systems, developed IEDs, had a pre-war insurgency plan in place called the Gafiki Project, where they developed all the IEDs. Months before we invaded Iraq, and they helped Al-Qaeda in Iraq by building car bombs, getting them targets. And Al-Qaeda would marry it up with some kid who comes from Saudi Arabia, would take his video, he'd jump into a car, the Baathists would say, hey, you know, there's a U.S. intelligence, you know, place over there. The guy would drive over there and blow up, do a video. However, by 2008, Al-Qaeda had developed its ground combat component. And the Baathists, as you know, when they had the Anbar Awakening, started demobilizing from insurgency by, you know, political agreements with the United States and the government of Iraq.
We were delivering a significant amount of cash and some other promises of power sharing.
Sure. And, you know, they essentially demobilized and stopped fighting by 2008. As a matter of fact, a good friend of mine was the key designer of the Anbar Awakening, who was later killed in a suicide bombing by Al-Qaeda, an American. So once that occurred, Al-Qaeda was on its wane. It was on its way down after, you know, 8 years of full-scale combat. But then the al-Maliki government, the Shia government in Iraq, decided to completely isolate the Baathists, give them no power, take away their ability to generate income from oil, demilitarized the units which they were supposed to patrol, you know, patrol their own areas with, you know, the Sunnah Triangle. And they suddenly realized they were out of business, out of employment again. And the only group that was hiring was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which by this time had changed its name to the Islamic State of Iraq. So all of those ex-Baathists folded into Islamic State of Iraq.
Now, let me just raise one thing that you haven't mentioned is the so-called surge. It seems to me, and tell me your assessment, obviously you have a much better sense of this, but from my perspective, it seems that the surge took place during that the awakening. And basically the surge was, ultimately a way of delivering the cash, essentially. And that it wasn't so much the absence of those military personnel when the surge ended, but rather the failure of the Shia and the Maliki government for delivering on the promises that were made during that time.
Absolutely. The surge was more of a vacuum-filling exercise. So that when they started to demobilize as part of the Anbar Awakening, right, and they became Sons of the Awakening, you know, the Sunnah ex-Baathists all came into the political process and laid down their arms and essentially stopped being terrorists.
And presumably en route to the process of becoming sort of rearmed as the protectors of that area under the auspices of the central government. Okay.
That's correct. Local militia with a little fractional bit of autonomy.
Okay.
Now, of course, this is where the political missteps came in. The Iraqi government didn't assist them at all. Didn't come forward with any of their promises. Essentially, decided they were going to have full Shia hegemony. And at that point, the only people who were hiring and could get them money, wealth, and prestige was the group Al-Qaeda in Iraq, now the Islamic State of Iraq. And so ISI at that point started doing intensive, humiliating operations because they were folding in very deeply committed Baathists into their ranks who had not just years of experience fighting the United States, but decades in taking terrain and oppressing people, right? These are the people that ran Iraq for almost half a century.
And these are the guys who developed the whole videotaping thing too, weren't they?
Yeah, and they had developed that very early. We saw the first videotapes as early as August of 2003, you know, documenting it. As a matter of fact, we would look out for what were called VST, video surveillance teams, which is, the second car near a suicide bombing that's got a guy with a video camera and, inside it. And it also had the trigger, the guy who would detonate the IED so that the suicide bomber couldn't back out of it. So all of this was now being molded together into an insurgent terrorist supergroup. And unfortunately, I wrote a book about this in 2007 that was only distributed amongst intelligence analysts in Iraq, where I predicted that, you know, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Baathists and all those Iraqi religious extremists would someday form a terrorist supergroup. That group was called the Islamic State of Iraq. And then in 2011, when they invaded, when Syria civil war started, they just went into Syria, sent their men, a group called the Jabhat al-Nusra, and took giant parts of Syria where they had been operating as allies and changed their name to the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, or Syria, the Levant.
And that is, they expanded there and began, they had a, basically a two-front or a more international front for recruitment at that point.
Yeah, they had a safe haven. Now, you have to understand why this is so appealing to the people inside the Anbar province and in the northern provinces of Iraq and west in eastern Syria. They had been supported 100% by Bashar al-Assad and his intelligence agencies, allowed them to operate with impunity in eastern Syria. So they knew right which buildings to go steal weapons. They knew which cities had to be seized, and they did it. They just filled the vacuum and took over most of eastern Syria. So the leadership of ISIS at this point, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, decided that there was a greater objective here. They could accelerate bin Laden's timeline to create a grand Islamic caliphate, but at the same time could carve out a Sunni homeland from the Golan Heights all the way to Fallujah and as far north as the Turkish border if they were to take Syria. And that's what their goal was to first take Syria, most of Syria, and then these major offensives in 2014 to seize all of their, you know, their traditional homes in Iraq. And that's what they did.
So their high watermark is
2014.
Is 2014, taking Mosul and I guess holding the dam for a couple of weeks. Was that basically the high watermark? And then then U.S. air power and Shia fighters, Iranian fighters, push them back? Is that where does that take us? And if that's accurate?
Yeah, June 2014, I would actually say September 2014 was their high watermark. I say September because it took a couple of months for the world to understand the real with real shock that these people were playing for keeps. This was not just, you know, terrorists on the march. This was, you know, beyond expeditionary warfare. They saw themselves. Remember, we talked earlier about how they have this 7th century mentality. They do this little dance between the 21st century and the 7th century. They saw themselves as performing the same, you know, expeditionary mobile warfare as the Prophet Muhammad did as he was going to take Mecca to reestablish Islam. Mm. And they thought that this is where we will establish our homeland. And any good, you know, they put out their call to the caliphate. They've reestablished the caliphate for the first time since 1924 when Ataturk eliminated it. And this is the homeland. At that point, they called in essentially all the chips on all their enemies. I mean, everyone, after trying to massacre the Yazidis, carrying out genocide, essentially micro-genocides against the Turkmens, against the Shia. Oh, they were killing every Shia they found. They essentially challenged the world to come and get them, and the world did. Hafez al-Assad tells you how old I am. Bashar al-Assad brought in Hezbollah, brought in the Iranian government, the government of Iraq brought in the Iranians and formed the popular mobilization units, these militias, and then the United States was bombing the hell out of them and then started reprofessionalizing the Iraqi or army that had collapsed. They are practically under siege right now. And it's not because the Russians bombed them. We bombed them extensively. We've struck over 23,000 targets. And if there was one man in each of the targets that we struck, that's 23,000 men that are dead. And that's a conservative number that the Defense Department came out with. The numbers are probably closer to 30 to 35,000 combatants were killed by us in airstrikes alone. So their numbers have dwindled down from the 50,000 that they were. They can't hold terrain anymore. The government, they hold terrain through suicide attack. They're great on the offense by suicide bombers. They're horrible on the defense because, like the Japanese and Iwo Jima and Okinawa, they can only win through suicide bombing. So they're losing their entire core, and it might be that within a year to two, they may be completely under the control. Not them, but the terrain that they had taken, including their capital city, Raqqa, under the control of their enemies.
So where are they strongest now? And if in a year they have lost the vast majority of their territory, where do they go, assuming they are still alive? And then I want to get to, you know, have we... Is the problem over at that point? I know the answer to that. Spoiler alert, it's probably no. But I want to get to what the potential solutions for that.
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny because the first time I had written about this, the effect of placing heavy kinetic power, military power, and troops on top of an insurgent enemy is equal to stepping on a ball of mercury, right? Mm. You place the pressure down, the mercury spreads thin, breaks up and spins out from under the point of pressure. You lift that pressure, it reconstitutes in multiple locations, and if possible, and even can reconstitute back into the original ball with very little loss. That is essentially what's going to happen with this, with the ISIS caliphate. They have been smart enough to propagate and speciate other countries with their ideology, with this fast-burning Al-Qaeda ideology. They've taken it to Egypt, where the Egyptians are engaged in a major, major war right now. And they always go to places where there's nothing, right? They go to places where there are voids of power or very little power. They do military-style attacks. They challenge the government. They carve out terrain. And right now, the Egyptians are fighting them on the border of Egypt and the West and the Gaza Strip in the area around Al-Rafah. In Libya, they are fighting, you know, the two forces that were fighting each other, one backed by the Qatari government, the other backed by, you know, the Egyptians and the UAE government, were fighting, and they completely ignored Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte, which was right down the middle of their two lines of control. And ISIS established there and immediately started attacking to take over all the oil assets of Libya. And while they were fighting ISIS there, another group popped up on the border of Tunisia to create an ISIS organization that's fighting in Tunisia and in Libya. So they have the ability, and as a matter of fact, since 2014, they've been sending the foreign fighters who couldn't get through Turkey anymore to all of these other countries. They're in Yemen, they're in Afghanistan, but they're not doing very well in Afghanistan. The Taliban actually has been dropping the dime and telling Central Command where they are. So we've been wiping them out in Afghanistan with the assistance of the Taliban. That's funny. And they are popping up all over the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa. And they understand that they may not be able to hold the heart of their caliphate, but like multiple balls of mercury, these were all supposed to come together and to create their nation state from Morocco to the Philippines.
So what happens if in a year from now they are essentially destroyed within Iraq and within Syria to a large extent? What happens with these disparate smaller balls of mercury? Is there basically one of these countries that you have mentioned? Do they become a bigger force there? And in terms of what America can do to avoid that, in other words, what mistakes are you concerned that the United States may make in response to one of these other areas of mercury, if you will?
Right. Well, you know, this is the beauty of a terrorist group that can go anywhere they want, you know, buy and steal weapons and then kill with impunity. Is they can go anywhere and where there's a vacuum in government power and establish within a day, you know, a little cell. Started out with 5 guys, move up to 10 guys, 50 guys come within a month, right? Right now, it looks like it's going to be Libya, but I don't believe that it's going to be central Libya in Sirte, where they've been fighting and holding right now, because the United States and the West have managed to mobilize and give special forces assistance to the both governments that have been fighting there in order to take on the ISIS threat. Tunisia is mobilizing its army to smash the ISIS threat in Tatooine and Sabratha, the western Libyan border. But southern Libya is just a den of thieves. It is literally the town of Sabratha in the south. It's all tribal run. All the lines of communications for migrants, food, weapons, everything that crosses the Sahara from as far south as Nigeria, all the way up to southern Libya, as far west as Mali and Mauritania, to as far east as Sudan. That is a big hole. And we've seen a lot of activity there. That's how Boko Haram in Nigeria gets their weapons from Libya. That's how Al-Qaeda and Ansar al-Dini and these other groups in the Trans-Sahel region is what it's called. That's a great place to hole up. Now, it's exposed to satellites. It's exposed to drones. But for the most part, it is not exposed to government control. And they can still bring in foreign fighters from all around the world legally into these countries for the most part, and then illicitly on these literal camel trails that, you know, you have big man trucks that carry 250 guys on it on the migrant route, and they can establish a new micro caliphate there.
So what, I mean, is there a role for the United States to play here, or is there enough chances of something going wrong? I mean, it seems to me that ISIS exists because of, the but for there is the invasion of Iraq. Not to mention that there's at least a strong argument, I don't know where you stand on this, but that our when we engage in a lot of the drone warfare, we are creating, future recruits for an entity like ISIS because you're attacking people from significantly far away, right. And you're bound to have civilians killed. Give me your assessment as to what the United States can do and what they should what we should definitely not do.
Right. Well, first, let me take on drone warfare. You know, I've used drones. I've not personally flown them, but I've certainly had these assets under my control, and saw the efficacy of them for surveillance and then striking. You know, later on, they are far more preferable, no matter what people say about the loss of civilian casualties, than to putting heavy ground forces on the ground. Over a minimum of 100,000 civilians were killed in Iraq due to the presence of the U.S. armed forces in that country. And that's just due to the dynamics of modern warfare and counterinsurgency. The enemy kills civilians by the handful. As we kill the enemy by the handful, civilians get killed in the crossfire. A drone will kill a single individual. And it's quite possible that someone might be within the blast radius of that single individual. But that, the people we're killing are people who are known to have killed, tens or thousands or caused hundreds of thousands to die. We are not injudicious with this weapon system. It is the scalpel that we need to use. We've literally obliterated ISIS's senior command in the last 12 months, wiping them out in Iraq and Syria, and every one of the dangerous people that are, high profile in the media. And eventually we're going to get their leader, al-Baghdadi, as well. So, the United States has to use these tools. Now,
but does that exist for? I mean, is that? I mean, that's. I mean, when you talk about Iraq and Syria, we're also talking about where there's sort of like an ongoing combat. But when right. we're striking in a place like, let's say, Pakistan or Yemen, I mean, clearly we've had instances where supposedly we've made mistakes.
Right.
Just Anwar al-Awlaki's son supposedly
sure.
was a complete fluke. I don't know if that's the case or not, but
Awlaki's son had a rifle and he was a combatant in a foreign terrorist group. It's unfortunate. My daughter works for the American Friends Society, big anti-drone program. However, I know, as someone who's a practitioner in the intelligence arts and warfighter, you really want us to use these systems wherever, because the alternative is just real, true open war. And for people who have never been to an open war, seen the effects of artillery or mortars or rockets on civilians, then you don't know that they just don't know what they're talking about. They just need to understand that war affects everyone, and it disproportionately kills civilians when it is uncontrolled. And a drone is a scalpel. Using a drone in Djibouti, flying out of Djibouti to strike people in Somalia, or flying into in Nigeria. You know, we just carried out a strike in Somalia, which was about, over 200 men were about to attack a major government headquarters. And we caught 125 of them, gathering together, and we struck them. Problem resolved. You know, we did not have to drop 200, 300 special forces or a Marine brigade in there, where thousands of people would have been killed through the kinetics of war fighting. And the United States has to work within these spheres right now. We have to stay out of the major ground war. The war to take out Gaddafi in Libya is about the extent of it. But you also have to come with the phase four. You have to know what you're going to do at the end of that war. And the people on the ground tend to dictate that. That's why Libya went south. I was there, in Benghazi with the Transitional National Council, and they did not want to create a central army that would challenge all of the tribes, and they all wanted each of the rebellion groups in the cities to have their own measure of autonomy, and it sprung up a vacuum for ISIS.
Let me ask you about
geopolitics.
About Gaddafi. I mean, was it wise in retrospect? I mean, I understand that it's you're describing a failure of a central authority to arise and exert control. But in retrospect, was that not knowable in the absence of Gaddafi? In other words, did we go beyond? Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that we went, and not just the United States, beyond the mandate of the UN. But did we go beyond the mandate of what made sense?
No, I don't believe we went beyond the mandate of the UN. And, I have an on-the-ground perspective of that. Gaddafi was not joking with his little speech about, we will hunt them from dar to dar, bait bait, zanga zanga, right? From, street to street, house to house, street to street, alley to alley. He was not joking. I saw the forces that were arrayed. We knew their operational orders, and there was going to be a mini genocide in Libya. He fully intended to kill everybody that was involved with the rebellion. So something had to be done.
The mandate was to protect the people of Benghazi, right? As opposed to regime change. I mean,
to protect the people of Benghazi was to allow the rebellion to happen as it did. Okay. And let me tell you, on the streets of Benghazi, those guys there at the time, they were not Islamists. They were, these were people who did not understand that you could literally go into the desert by yourself with your car. They were so terrified of the regime and what the regime had put into their heads. It was fascinating. I mean, I spent my entire career in the Middle East, and it was the first place I saw people terrified of going in the desert, because that meant you were engaging in sedition and could be tortured, executed, and killed. So
people are afraid to evacuate
for, advancement in their lives, really just a new car. That's what most of them wanted, but they weren't going to get it under Gaddafi. And it was a naturally, it was another effect of the Arab Spring.
Interesting. Okay. And so the key from what you're saying is that, the U.S. has to avoid at the very least a ground invasion in any of these areas. Are there other potential pitfalls in terms of regime change?
Well, there certainly is. We need to, and this is where professionals like myself, Arabists, people who have studied the ground game in the Middle East, and know the people in the tribal structures, have to be listened to. The Bush administration literally excluded anyone with Middle Eastern knowledge and background from taking part in planning what was going to go on in the post-Iraq war. The Obama administration is a lot smarter about that. However, they, the dynamics of the Middle East are not under our control anymore. We just can't threaten economic sanctions with a strong man and expect him to rein himself in. Since the Arab awakening, Arab Spring, the people of the Middle East, once you take out their leader, there literally is no structure under them that can be controlled. It is coming down to people, tribes, mafias, militias. And this is the new dynamic that the Middle East has to be worked with. And we have to try to reestablish strong central governments. And with those strong central governments, you have to bring in and train a strong central army and give them assistance, like you're seeing we're doing in Iraq. Now, it may require a few, you know, 100 special operations people who can come in and give you, you know, what we call advise and assist and, you know, airstrike power to take on these terrorist groups. But that needs to be about the extent of it. If we get involved, certainly with ISIS-backed groups, into these large ground wars, it will just be another 50,000 people that will come out of nowhere and join these groups.
Is there anything that we can do on the sort of ideological front to avoid or to mitigate the threat like we saw in Paris and Belgium?
Yes. You know, the ideology of ISIS and Al-Qaeda is absolutely a target. This is where the United States has failed for well over the last 15 years. We just do not want to discuss what they believe in. And it's interesting because in the last year, since the invasion of, you know, ISIS's invasion of Western Iraq and Northern Iraq, only then since, you know, have we seen the ideology discussed by any of the academics. You know, I've written 3 books on ISIS's and Al-Qaeda's ideology. And one of the components you have to foster is what we call counter-ideological warfare. Now, in the old days, we called this propaganda and psychological operations. However, in the modern world, it is much deeper than that. You know, the Muslim world is desperate for the West to understand that these people, not only do they not represent Islam, their behaviors are wholly un-Islamic to the point that they're anti-Islamic. And they themselves will refer to them as deviants, as the Khawarij, that first cult that popped up in Islam. But their megaphone, their capacity to override Western news media's fascination with ISIS is just not being done. You know, we are just not assisting them well.
Before you tell us how you can assist them, why has there been such hesitation to discuss what they believe in? Or why do you think there's been?
Well, principally because of the way that the more conservative facets of Western political thought here in the United States have certainly demonized Islam as a whole. And by demonizing Islam, they've allowed ISIS to become the figurehead and spokesman for what they have, you know, this caricature that they have formed of the Muslim world. And by having their own media outlets, by having the ability to propagate this information on not just a national scale on a political scale, but an international scale, they have essentially allowed ISIS to speak, ISIS and Al-Qaeda's ideology, to be branded as Islam. And that is wholly and completely wrong. And when you look at it, we are fighting and have been fighting since well before 9/11 in the defense of Islam, in the defense of the Muslim world, against people who have deviated and have created these cults and are fighting for the elimination, not just of the Western world, but of Islam itself.
So what do we need to do at this instance? I mean, assuming that we can in some way tame the impulse, is it not taming necessarily the impulse of the right in this country and some on the nominal left to demonize Islam as a whole? But what is it? How do we take that step to fight the ideology?
Right. Well, for the most part, you know, setting our own politics aside, because we do have freedom of speech, we at a political level need to understand that we have to empower the Muslim world to develop its own counter-narrative, which is very simple. They have to return to traditional Islam or understand that the Muslim world itself has mechanisms to destroy them, and that's their own jihad. Now, I'm not calling for a jihad, but what I am saying is that the Muslim world has to be given the resources, whether you're going to go out and help them, you know, you know, better forms of propaganda. We do these leaflet drops in Iraq and Syria that are just laughable. We drop millions of leaflets that somebody in Fort Bragg has developed that, you know, shows ISIS putting men in a meat grinder. And ISIS loves these propaganda drops.
Because it scares
Whereas
people.
The thing that would actually terrify a member of their group or the people who are giving them logistics support, who are, you know, selling the meat on a day-to-day basis, is the fact that they need to understand that it's not their lives that are at stake and that they're fighting for their lives. No, they want to give up their lives. It's their soul that is at stake. And the only people who can clearly present that message are the religious bodies of the Muslim world and the people of the Muslim world who must create. We have to help them create a campaign to tell them that they must return to Islam, traditional Islam. Right. And that, you know, the head of the Saudi ulema, you know, called ISIS the number one enemy of Islam. He referred to them as that in 2014. And no one in the Western media has said a word about this. You know, they need to understand that continuing in this insurgency, this cultish insurgency, it's their soul that it's at risk. So don't drop leaflets of guys, you know, being ground up in the meat grinder. I mean, that's just a joke. But if they were to have the proper quotes from the Quran put into context with an explainer that you are never getting to heaven, you know, God is going to judge you harshly. You need to return to Islam and understand that the traditions of tolerance and respect are what you're fighting against. Then you'll create an ideological revolution within the organization itself. Some of them are going to be, you know, unreconcilable. They will have to be destroyed kinetically. But the guy who is selling them water does not want to go to hell.
So if I hear you correctly, if I gave you a budget, I don't know, you give me the number, but you have that budget, you would make sure that the comments coming from the Islamic world that indicate that ISIS is not true Islam would get more prominence. Maybe you'd start a PR firm and you would try and place interviews with this guy. But you do leaflets. You just change the nature. Is that it, or what else would you do?
It has to be a campaign. You know, we literally have to work to communicate to the Muslim world that what they are doing, not to the Muslim world, for the Muslim world, that, you know, on every asset, you know, not a single line of communications, you know, at the State Department. You know, a single Twitter feed. You have to have thousands of Twitter feeds in Arabic. State Department created its equal in the United Arab Emirates, the Sawab Center, and they have another organization, Hadayah Center. Okay, now there's two Twitter feeds in Arabic against ISIS's thousands of Twitter feeds. You have to also go at them via media. There should be an international campaign, which the Saudis are rich enough to run this by themselves, to where they have to vilify this group and call for their return to Islam. When you do that, you establish a clear wall between the two ideologies. And, you know, it's funny because the Saudis have been doing these terror media within their nation for the last 15 years against Al-Qaeda, and it's very effective. But ISIS members, they don't care what their family thinks. They don't care what their country thinks. They will fight to the death. But the people who are supporting them, the people who are buying their antiquities, who are selling them ammunition, okay, they need to understand there's only two ways out of this, death or a return to the fold of the community. And their cult ideology has to be explained, that the Mahdi is not going to return and the Prophet Jesus are not going to return if you are executing people by the thousands and enslaving people by the tens of thousands.
It's crazy because I think a lot of people just assume, like, there's got to be more than one Twitter feed that's going, you know, like, it seems a fairly sort of, that seems to be a sort of the low-hanging fruit, right? I guess it's just,
it's very low-hanging fruit. And Tapestry, my think tank, we're actually a virtual think tank. We actually call ourselves a do tank because we take action. We do you know, go into their, you know, dark web internet sites and leave propaganda bombs and things like that. But, you know, mainly it's an experimental mode, and we've been, you know, in communication with parts of the U.S. government, and they're just deathly afraid to touch Islam, to even discuss it. And to the point where, you know, they won't even use our Arab allies to do this.
Because,
our Arab allies
because domestically,
are waiting for us.
Because domestically it is, they are boxed in.
Well, then that means that we, you know, I said this to a staffer of Cory Booker, Senator Cory Booker, and I went in and I had this whole discussion. I said, look, I'm bringing 35 years of hardcore intelligence operations experience here. You guys need to go back to what you did to the communists, right? You need to go back and spell out an alternative version of who they are. Otherwise, they will characterize themselves in the Muslim world for you. And when I said, you know, we have to help the Muslim world speak out, and he said, well, now you're talking about discussing the validity of their Islam. So pretty much this conversation is over.
Wow.
And I said, you have just told me you've surrendered Islam to ISIS. And he was flummoxed. You know, we have to take this on, and we can facilitate our allies and not do the speaking ourselves, but we can certainly become the megaphone for them.
That's amazing. And how, I mean, basically the story is we are so boxed in by the venom on the right, or just the anti-Islam, the Islamophobia. I mean, I would imagine, like, you know, the idea is, well, I mean, I get, you know, then there's a whole nother conversation as to whether domestically, you know, maybe as Donald Trump flames out, maybe there is, you know, some way of talking about this distinction rationally. But
well, let me make one statement about that. Islamophobia is ISIS's greatest weapon system.
Because it chills the sort of the ability to make a distinction between what they're doing and what Islam is.
Yeah, well, you validated everything that ISIS says about the West, that Al-Qaeda has been saying about the West, that Bin Laden wrote entire books on about the West. And you prove to those people who are, you know, who are on the fence, as the Onion cartoon, you know, the Onion comment was that, you know, Muslim on the fence about terrorism kicked off by Trump. You know,
yeah,
as an intelligence practitioner, okay, we need every asset of our allies, and we need to understand that we are losing U.S. soldier service, airmen, Marines, young men and women, intelligence professionals in the defense of traditional Islam, and that comments against that, which alienate our allies, assist our enemy in the killing U.S. service member and intelligence staff and diplomatic staff. And it needs to, that line needs to be drawn, and we need to distinguish between traditional Islam and the terrorist cult variation. And if we don't, we just facilitate, whoever speaks Islamophobia facilitates the death of our own service people.
Malcolm Nance, the book is Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. We will put a link to that book and Tapestry at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, have we gone long in this program today? But whatever, folks. Enjoy. One thing I want to point out that I'm going to contact him, and I don't do this terribly often after an interview, but, and I don't know if he misspoke, but I have never seen it reported anywhere. I've never seen it contended by anyone in the administration that I just have never seen any hide nor hair of a report that Anwar al-Awlaki's son, Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, had a rifle, or that he, or any even charge that he was in any way affiliated with any type of armed militia or anything like that. I've never heard that. I've never read it anywhere. I've never seen it. So I'm going to email him and ask him about that. I don't know if this is something that is believed in intelligence circles or if he misspoke. At the time of this interview, a week or two ago, I thought perhaps maybe I was unaware of subsequent reporting, which, I mean, it never happens, but it's possible, theoretically. So I'm going to check in with him on that. You know, there are obviously some things that I have a different opinion about. You know, I think there's probably a third answer. It's not necessarily have to be ground invasion where you kill hundreds of thousands of people. I don't know that the only other answer is to kill a much smaller amount of people through drones. Nevertheless, you know, that's a difference of opinion as to the need for that. But one thing is clear. This guy, in the course of his 35 years of experience in this world and his deep understanding and lived experience in the Muslim world, really destroyed the arguments we hear about regressive leftists when it comes to Islam, destroyed the arguments of...
He was a total apologist for
I mean,
the religion.
You know, there it is. But
not one thought experiment.
We should actually like cut those up, like maybe even a segment or two of that on YouTube, just to, like, here's... that sound you hear is... someone's philosophy dissertation going up in flames. I'm not going to say any names.
Yeah. He who All shall right. not be named getting Marshall McLuhan.
All right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right. Going to take a quick break. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. We've had a lot of people who have, I don't know if, you know, there are oftentimes I wonder, like, am I seeing an indicator of the economy? at different times, but we've had a lot of people who over the past couple of weeks have had to cancel their membership for financial reasons. Sometimes it's just some people have bad luck, but we rely on members for our operating budget for just about all of it. I mean, occasionally we have a day where we have two or three ads, but it's not, I can assure you, we just simply don't have the kind of numbers, and we're never going to have. I mean, it's the politics have a ceiling. I've been told this over and over and over again by sales reps from podcast, mid-roll, ad rock, blah, blah, whatever. But any chance you could do anything else? And... I said, I wish. So that's the business model that we have. So if you have the ability to support the program, please do. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it from our link at majorityreportkickback.com. But if you don't want to buy stuff from Amazon, you want to buy it from a company that has reportedly much better labor practices and a lot less of a monopoly issue, jet.com. And you can go through Majority Report, kickback.com to buy your stuff through jet.com. All right, going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The phones are working today. Also, you can IM us. We'll be right back. Got a lot of sound.